Imagine you're sitting on a therapist's couch, right? You are just desperate to explain the absolute worst thing that ever happened to you. Your mouth is open, you really want to speak, but you physically cannot make a single sound.
Right, yeah, it's a terrifying feeling.
It really is. And for decades, psychology called this, you know, stubbornness or resistance.
Mm-hmm.
We were all handed this cultural script that the absolute best way to heal from painful experiences is to go into a quiet room, sit down, and just talk about them. Find the logic, tell the story.
Which we now know is just, well, it's missing the point entirely.
Exactly, because today we know that this inability to speak isn't resistance at all.
Yeah.
It's a biological paralysis.
It is a profound, literal roadblock. You're sitting there genuinely trying to explain what happened, but your heart rate is hitting like 120 beats a minute. Your throat is completely restricted. And your brain has entirely severed your access to language. Yeah, we used to view this purely as a psychological hurdle, you know? Just try harder. But now, the clinical world understands it is pure neurobiology. The body is fundamentally blocking the process.
Which brings us perfectly to the core of today's deep dive.
Mm.
We have a genuinely massive stack of sources to explore for you today. We're looking at articles breaking down the groundbreaking research of psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk.
He's the absolute pioneer in this space.
Oh, without a doubt. He really mapped out how trauma is stored in the physical body. We are also pulling from clinical guides on EMDR, which stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing, alongside some really detailed comparative breakdowns of somatic experiencing.
Which are both just fascinating modalities.
They really are. And our mission for this deep dive is to understand exactly how trauma fundamentally rewires the brain and the body, and to explore these evidence-based therapies that heal trauma, you know, without relying exclusively on talk therapy.
I mean, the literature we're covering today is a massive paradigm shift.
Yeah.
But before we can even begin to understand how to heal without talking, we really have to look at the mechanics of why talking fails us in the first place.
Right.
We need to walk through what actually happens inside the brain when an overwhelming event occurs, and probably more importantly, what happens years later when someone is simply triggered by a memory.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I think we need to make it concrete for you listening.
Yeah.
Imagine a totally mundane scenario, say, a heavy door slams shut in the hallway. Walk us through that millisecond by millisecond cascade in a traumatized brain, because
right.
The sources emphasize that this is not just, you know, hurt feelings. This is a measurable alteration in neural architecture.
Yeah, it's structural. So that door slams. The sound enters your ear and hits a part of the brain called the thalamus. And the thalamus acts like a sensory relay station.
Like a sorting office.
Yeah, exactly. In a typical brain, the thalamus sends that signal to the cortex to be analyzed to determine, oh, it's just a door. But in a traumatized brain, the threat response is hypersensitized. The signal bypasses the rational brain entirely and takes a shortcut straight to the amygdala.
And the amygdala is the alarm system, right?
Spot on. It's your brain's primal alarm system. In survivors, this alarm is essentially stuck in the on position. It fires before you even have a conscious thought about the noise.
So your body starts reacting before you even know what you're reacting to.
Yeah.
The heart spikes, adrenaline just floods the system.
Exactly that. And as the amygdala floods the system with panic, the hippocampus starts to fail.
Wait, fail how?
Well, the hippocampus is supposed to file your memories and give them a timestamp. It is the part of your brain that tells you, hey, this dangerous thing happened in the past and it is over now.
Okay, so it gives it context.
Right. But under the chronic stress of trauma, toxic levels of cortisol actually cause the hippocampus to physically shrink. It literally loses volume, so it completely fails to timestamp the memory.
That is wild. It physically shrinks.
It does. And because of that, the past and the present collapse into one another. When that door slams, your brain doesn't think you are remembering a past trauma. It genuinely believes the original trauma is happening right now, in this exact second.
I'm going to pause on that because it explains the terrifying reality of a flashback for so many people.
You think?
It's not just a memory, it's a literal re-experiencing.
Yes, exactly.
And while the amygdala is screaming and the hippocampus is dropping the ball, what is happening to the logical part of the brain? The sources talk heaps about the prefrontal cortex going offline, but how does that actually work mechanically?
So The prefrontal cortex is your center for logic, reasoning, and emotional regulation. It's the CEO of the brain. It's supposed to be the mechanism that sends a calming signal down to the amygdala saying, false alarm, it's just the wind.
Right, yeah.
But trauma disrupts the neural pathways connecting these regions. When the amygdala surges, it basically demands all the brain's energy and resources for immediate survival. The blood flow literally shifts away from the frontal lobes.
Oh, wow. So it's an energy crisis.
Pretty much. The rational brain doesn't just decide to step back. It is starved of resources and powered down. You lose the biological hardware required to process the situation logically.
And then comes the final piece of the puzzle, which is Broca's area. This is the brain's speech center. During a traumatic event and during subsequent triggers, functional brain scans show significantly reduced blood flow and activity in Broca's area.
It essentially goes dark.
Yeah, which creates that phenomenon of speechless terror.
What's fascinating here is how incredibly validating these brain scans are for survivors. You know, people who constantly wonder, what's wrong with me? Why am I overreacting?
Yeah, the guilt they carry is massive.
It is, but the science provides a definitive answer here. There is absolutely nothing wrong with your character. You have a neurobiological injury. Your brain is executing a survival program it learned when you were in actual danger, and it's doing it flawlessly. It just doesn't realize the danger has passed.
Yeah. And looking at those four massive brain changes, trying to use traditional talk therapy on a traumatized nervous system is like, I don't know, trying to have a calm, rational conversation with someone about fire safety while they are actively on fire.
That is the perfect analogy.
Right. Because if the brain's language center is literally offline, and the logical brain is starved of blood flow, aren't we just setting people up for catastrophic failure by forcing them to narrate their trauma week after week?
I'd argue it's even worse than setting them up to fail. We are actively risking re-traumatization.
Because they're just reliving it.
Exactly. When you force someone to repeatedly recount the worst moments of their life, you are forcing them to access the memory. But because their hippocampus can't tell the difference between past and present, their body mounts the exact same physiological stress response as the day the trauma occurred.
The heart rate spikes, stress hormones flood the system, digestion just completely stops.
Yeah, but because they are just sitting on a therapist's couch, they can't fight or flee. Their nervous system learns absolutely nothing new about safety. They just practice feeling terrified.
Which forces us to ask, if the brain's language center is offline and the logical brain can't file the memory away, where does the memory go?
Yeah.
Because it obviously doesn't just vanish into thin air.
No, it doesn't.
The research suggests it shatters. It fragments into the body.
It bypasses language entirely and encodes as pure sensory data. A traumatic memory might not be a visual story for you. It might be chronic, unexplained muscle tension in your jaw or your shoulders.
Or severe gastrointestinal issues.
Yes. It could be the smell of a specific cologne instantly making you nauseous. Or a certain tone of voice making you want to sprint out of the room, your body literally becomes the archive of the things you couldn't process.
And this brings us to interoception, which I found to be one of the most compelling concepts in Van der Kolk's work.
Hmm?
Interoception is your ability to sense what is happening inside your own physical body.
Right.
It's how you know you're hungry, or that you need to use the bathroom, or that your muscles are tense. Trauma severely disrupts this internal tracking system.
It completely devastates it. Think about it from a survival perspective. During a traumatic event, the body was a place of profound danger and agony. To survive that, the brain employs a brilliant, desperate defense mechanism. It cuts the cord.
It just disconnects.
It completely severs the connection between the mind and the body. Consequently, survivors often numb out entirely. They walk around completely disconnected from their physical selves, unable to feel pain or hunger. Or, and we see this a lot, they swing to the absolute opposite extreme.
Meaning they become hypervigilant to every normal bodily signal.
Precisely.
Like interpreting the natural heart rate increase from walking up a flight of stairs as the beginning of a massive heart attack.
Exactly. Their internal alarm system has lost all nuance. Every single physical sensation is interpreted as a life or death emergency.
To really understand how to map these bodily reactions, the sources lean heavily into Stephen Porges's polyvagal theory. Now, this maps out how our nervous system navigates safety and danger via the vagus nerve, which is essentially the superhighway of information between the brain and the gut.
It's a huge component of all this.
So how do we actually shift through these different states of safety and panic?
Well, Polyvagal theory outlines a hierarchy of three distinct physiological states. The top tier is the ventral vagal state. This is your system of social engagement. You feel safe, your heart rate is calm, you can make eye contact, digest food, and learn new things.
That's where we want to be.
Ideally, yeah. But let's say a threat appears. Your nervous system detects danger, a process Porges calls neuroception, and it shifts down into the second state, which is the sympathetic nervous system.
The classic fight or flight.
Exactly. The vagus nerve dials back, adrenaline and cortisol pump into your bloodstream, your pupils dilate, and blood rushes to your limbs so you can literally run or fight for your life.
But the crucial part of the sources is what happens when fighting or running is biologically impossible. And what if you are physically trapped? Or what if you are a child who is entirely dependent on the person causing the danger?
That is when you plummet into the most primal, ancient state of all the dorsal vagal state.
The freeze response.
The freeze, shutdown, or dissociation response, yeah. Your nervous system concludes that death or severe injury is imminent, so it initiates a biological shutdown to minimize pain. Your heart rate plummets, your breathing becomes shallow, your pain receptors numb out, and you just disconnect from reality.
Wow.
And people with unresolved trauma, they spend years cycling wildly between the burning panic of the sympathetic state and the deadened collapse of the dorsal vagal state. They rarely, if ever, find their way back up to ventral vagal safety.
Now, the sources make a really sharp distinction between how this presents depending on the trauma type. They contrast shock trauma, which is a single adult incident like a car crash, with developmental trauma, which involves ongoing chronic adversity during childhood, often leading to complex PTSD.
Right. The landscape is very different.
So what does this all mean for clients with limited verbal capacity? Like those who experience trauma as pre-verbal infants or toddlers? Because for those of you listening who relate to this, the trauma is entirely locked in the body. Wow. You literally didn't have the vocabulary to describe what was happening when the trauma occurred.
It's a vital point, and it fundamentally changes how we must approach treatment. For pre-verbal trauma or severe childhood abuse, where dissociation is the primary coping mechanism, the memory was never a narrative to begin with.
There is no story.
Exactly. There is no story. The memory only exists as somatic imprints, a chronic clenching of the stomach, a reflexive flinching away from touch. For these individuals, starting with talk therapy is like trying to read a book in a language you haven't even learned the alphabet for.
You're just staring at blank pages.
Yeah. The therapeutic entry point has to bypass the narrative brain completely. It must speak directly to the nervous system. The body absolutely has to lead the conversation.
So if trauma lives in the body and disrupts the nervous system, healing has to start from the bottom up. We have to stabilize the physical vessel before we can even think about touching the brain's memories. And the premier modality for this bottom-up work is somatic experiencing, developed by Dr. Peter Levine.
Somatic experiencing, or SE, targets that trapped dorsal vagal freeze response we talked about. Levine spent years studying animals in the wild. He noticed that an antelope, after surviving a cheetah attack, will literally shake and tremble violently.
Like a full-body tremor.
Yeah. And what they are doing is mechanically discharging the massive amounts of adrenaline and survival energy generated during the chase. Humans, however, are conditioned by society to suppress that trembling. We tell people to calm down or hold it together.
Right, it's seen as a sign of weakness to shake.
Exactly. But because we don't discharge that energy, it gets trapped in the nervous system and becomes chronic trauma symptoms. SE uses the body's internal sensations to gently help the vagus nerve release that pent-up energy.
And the operative word there is gently. The sources detail a technique called titration. You aren't diving into the deep end of the trauma. You are approaching the physical sensation of the trauma in tiny, manageable, almost microscopic doses.
Tiny drops.
Right. You notice a slight tightness in the chest, and you just observe it without trying to change it. And this is paired with another core concept, which is pendulation.
Pendulation is really about rhythm. It's the deliberate swinging of your attention between a state of relative safety in your body and a state of slight activation.
It makes me think of pendulation like, you know, when you go swimming in the freezing Tasman Sea in the middle of winter, you don't just dive headfirst into the freezing water. You go into shock.
Right. Yeah, you'd freeze.
You dip a toe in, then you step back onto the warm sand and wait a second. You let your body regulate, and then you step a little further into the water. You repeat that back and forth process until your body acclimatizes to the shock of the cold.
That's exactly it.
You are basically teaching your nervous system that it can handle the discomfort because the safety of the beach is always right there.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what you are doing with that toe dipping is expanding what psychiatrists call the window of tolerance. This is the physiological zone where you can experience stress, physical sensations, and emotions without either flying into a sympathetic panic or collapsing into a dorsal vagal shutdown.
You're widening the safe zone.
Yes. Somatic experiencing slowly stretches the boundaries of that window. You are fundamentally teaching your brain that you can feel a racing heart or a tight muscle, and it doesn't mean you are in mortal peril.
Another incredible bottom-up tool mentioned heavily is trauma-sensitive yoga, which, to be absolutely clear, is fundamentally different from a standard gym yoga class where everyone is sweating and trying to perfect their downward dog.
Oh, completely different. In a standard class, teachers might walk around and physically adjust your posture. But for a trauma survivor, a surprise physical touch from behind can instantly trigger an amygdala hijack.
Yeah, that would be terrifying.
Trauma-sensitive yoga strips all of that away. There are no hands-on adjustments. The instructor uses purely invitational language. Instead of commanding, stretch your arms up, they will say, if you'd like to, you might experiment with raising your arm and notice how your shoulder feels.
It's entirely about reclaiming bodily ownership.
Mm-hmm.
It focuses on internal sensation, that interoception we talked about earlier, rather than external appearance or performance.
Exactly.
It's a safe, controlled environment to gently teach your nervous system that your body belongs to you again, and you have agency over how it moves.
It repairs that severed connection between the mind and physical form. Now, once someone has done this bottom-up work, once they have expanded their window of tolerance and their body feels like a relatively safe place to inhabit, only then is the brain finally ready to process the fragmented memory network.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the gold standard for that reprocessing is EMDR eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, developed by Francine Shapiro. To understand how EMDR works, we have to look at the Adaptive Information Processing Model, or AIP.
Which is such a hopeful framework, honestly.
It really is. This theory suggests that our brains are naturally wired to heal from psychological wounds, just like your skin heals from a cut. But trauma acts like a massive splinter. It causes an infection that blocks the natural healing process. EMDR acts as the neurological tweezers. But how does moving your eyes back and forth actually pull the splinter out?
Well, it all comes down to bilateral stimulation. In an EMDR session, the therapist might have you track their fingers side to side with your eyes, or you might hold small buzzers that vibrate, alternating between your left and right hands.
So it's left, right, left, right.
Exactly. By forcing your eyes or your attention to cross the midline of your body, you are forcing the left and right hemispheres of your brain to communicate rapidly. This bilateral stimulation mechanically mimics what happens during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep.
Which is the phase of sleep where our brains naturally process the events of the day, make sense of them, and file them away into long-term memory.
Precisely. But during a trauma, that filing process failed. The memory got stuck in the reactive amygdala. In EMDR, you hold a fragment of the traumatic memory in your mind while engaging in the bilateral stimulation.
And what does that do?
The eye movements basically jumpstart the brain's stalled processing system. It unfreezes the neural pathway, allowing the brain to physically move that stuck memory out of the amygdala and securely file it away in the narrative memory centers of the prefrontal cortex and hippocampus.
That's amazing.
It really is. The memory isn't erased. You still remember what happened, but the emotional and physiological panic attached to it is completely neutralized.
And because of this biological mechanism, EMDR doesn't look or feel anything like traditional therapy. You don't have to vocalize every excruciating detail of the worst day of your life to the therapist.
No.
You can just hold the image internally while the bilateral stimulation does the heavy lifting.
Right, which makes it so much more accessible.
It's a highly structured, 8-phase protocol, and it's so incredibly effective that the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs in the U.S., lists it as a recommended best practice for treating PTSD.
It is a massive relief for people who cannot speak about what happened. Now, the sources do briefly touch on a few other somatic modalities that use similar principles. For instance, neurofeedback.
Oh, yeah, the brainwave training.
Exactly. This involves sitting in a chair with electrodes on your scalp, reading your brainwaves in real time. You might watch a movie on a screen. When your brain produces dysregulated, panicked brainwaves, the movie blurs or the audio drops out. But when your brain produces calm, regulated waves, The movie plays perfectly.
It's essentially operant conditioning for your central nervous system.
Spot on. Over multiple sessions, your brain subconsciously learns how to self-regulate to keep the reward of the clear movie coming.
The sources also mention EFT, or emotional freedom techniques, which is commonly known as tapping. In EFT, you tap on specific acupressure or meridian points on your face and upper body while focusing on a distressing memory.
Yeah, and the mechanism there is really interesting.
Right, because the mechanical action of tapping generates a physical signal that travels through the connective tissue directly to the amygdala, sending a dampening, calming signal. You're essentially pairing the traumatic thought with a physical signal of safety, decoupling the memory from the panic response.
This raises an important question, though, regarding when to use which therapy. Because in trauma treatment, the order of operations matters deeply.
You can't just mix and match randomly.
Definitely not. If an individual has suffered a single incident shock trauma, say, a recent car accident, but they had a generally safe childhood and a well-regulated nervous system prior to the crash, EMDR can be brilliant straight away. Their nervous system has the internal resources to handle the reprocessing.
But wait, if we are talking about complex developmental trauma, you know, someone with severe childhood abuse and high levels of dissociation, can you just throw them into EMDR?
No, and doing so can actually be incredibly dangerous. For complex trauma, jumping straight into EMDR can trigger a massive amygdala hijack. If they don't have a foundation of bodily safety, focusing on the traumatic memory, even with bilateral stimulation, will cause them to panic, dissociate, and essentially flee their own body.
They will drop straight into that dorsal vagal freeze we talked about.
Exactly.
So for complex trauma, the gold standard strategy has to be sequential. You must start with somatic, experiencing, or trauma-informed yoga to ground the body, build that window of tolerance, and regulate the vagus nerve.
Mm.
You do the bottom-up work first.
Yes, the foundation has to be there.
Then, and only then, once the physical vessel is stable and interoception is restored, do you bring in EMDR to reprocess the mind.
That is the crucial takeaway. Somatic experiencing addresses the physical tension and the freeze response, while EMDR processes the cognitive and emotional memory. Together, they create a holistic healing protocol that actually honors the biological reality of how trauma is stored.
It fundamentally changes everything about how we approach mental health. To wrap up this deep dive, if you take nothing else away from these sources, let it be this. Trauma is not a character flaw.
Absolutely.
It is not a sign of weakness, and it is not a lack of willpower. It is a measurable neurobiological injury. It physically alters your amygdala, shrinks your hippocampus, and knocks your language centers offline. So if you've been sitting on a therapist's couch for years, talking until you blew in the face and it just hasn't worked, it is not because you aren't trying hard enough.
No, it's really not.
It's because your language center was knocked offline. And your body desperately needs to lead the conversation.
It is a biological reality that demands a biological approach.
Mm-hmm.
And to leave you with a final thought to mull over as we finish up next time you experience an unexplained physical tension or racing heart or a sudden urge to completely withdraw from the room, what if you stopped trying to logic it away?
Yeah.
What if instead you paused and asked yourself, what is my nervous system brilliantly trying to protect me from right now? And how can I show my body that we are finally safe?